It's important that you understand this chapter's emphasis within the framework of this book's overall structure. As you begin to embrace the foundational principle, you can't change what you don't acknowledge, you should keep in mind that this is only chapter 4. Don't be disappointed or discard this concept as unusual because it doesn't work for you right away. In fact, you shouldn't expect to be able to make the big, powerful changes in your life using this concept alone. The reason is because you can't change what you don't acknowledge isn't even a tool, it's a foundational principle. Because we aren't yet discussing tools and techniques for taking life-changing steps, it will be best to simply read and absorb the material in this chapter and wait until later to see ways to apply it. Every day I see people wearing blinders in both their business and personal lives. As a business owner and entrepreneur, one of the necessary evils in my business is that I have to let people go for my organization. In most cases, it's because they just won't see what they need to change, even when you give them all the answers. For example, occasionally, we'll have someone in our office who is new in sales and their numbers are lower than they should be. I'll sit down with them and try to help them out. My staff knows I've been in sales for many years and they recognize that I know my company's product and services better than anyone. In a heart-to-heart, I'll tell them the reason that their numbers are down is because they aren't making enough calls. Sometimes the response I get is, "Oh, I'm making calls. I'm on the phone all day long." Now, there are those on my team who respond in open-minded ways, and those are the folks who are still with me. If they ask me how to wrap up sales calls more quickly so they can place a greater number of calls, I know they get it. If they come to me when they see their numbers are down and ask for help or coaching, I know they get it. My experience is that when I find someone who is willing to learn and isn't so defensive, they will grow and become an exceptional team member. People who are defensive or argue about their numbers don't necessarily question my experience, product knowledge, or sales ability. They just don't believe that they did anything wrong. They even think that I must be wrong about how many calls they're making. Sure, sales are down, but it must be because of something else. Perhaps it's just a bad streak of luck. Power tip: hope keeps everything alive. In order for someone to be able to recognize problems and make changes, several thought processes must be in place. They must have an open mind, a humble attitude, and the ability to not take themselves too seriously. It may be hard or even impossible depending on where they are in their life, but they need to be honest with themselves. So let's go back to my original observation. My statement was, "You're not making enough calls." In this scenario, what must change is that they must make more calls. No excuses, just more calls. No emotion, no extra time in the office, just more calls. Because you can't change what you don't acknowledge, if they continue to insist that they are already making enough calls, it won't be long before they're on their way out the door. Excuses are pointless and just a waste of time. They don't help you overcome challenges, and they don't help you realize what you need to change. While there are all kinds of things in life which help us avoid personal responsibility, that doesn't mean we should. We've got to quit blaming other people and other things for our failures in life. We live in an irresponsible world where so many people blame anyone and everything else for their failures, but they don't hesitate to take the credit for successes. Let's say that you and I are close friends and I tell you, "I have had it, I am throwing in the towel." Whose fault is it that I'm quitting? That's easy, it's mine. A good friend wouldn't pull any punches and you'd tell it like it is. It's my choice, my fault if I quit. But consider this, my father was murdered and I miss him. Now whose fault is it if I want to throw in the towel or constantly make excuses for my failures? Truthfully, it's my fault. Okay, but I lost all my savings paying for my newborn's special needs and hospital bills ate me alive. Now whose fault is it that I'm quitting? Give me a break. My wife said my son isn't mine. My uncle was killed in a plane crash. How much can one person be expected to take? It's just not fair. I think I have every right to quit or at least make a bunch of excuses for failing. But if I quit now, if I throw in the towel after all that, whose fault is it really? It's still mine. For some reason, our society wants to enable people who make excuses because something in life isn't fair. But the bottom line is that quitting is my fault. So if you want to quit, if you've got a ton of great reasons to quit, whose fault is it really if you quit? Are you limiting your potential because you're blaming others or even yourself? People are suing restaurants because they claim it's the restaurant's fault that they're fat. Give me a break. As a society, we need to take a collective breath and say to ourselves, I am responsible for my own actions and the results of my actions. The craziness doesn't seem to stop. It is in every part of our society. I recently attended a helicopter training school and heard about another circumstance. Whenever you land a helicopter, you're supposed to idle for a few minutes to let the engine cool down. Then after you shut the engine off, it's standard practice to let the rotors come to a complete stop before exiting the craft. Sure, there are times people exit or board helicopters while the rotors are still spinning, and there are times people ride in cars without seatbelts. If you can avoid either circumstances, you should. It's just common sense. What's more, because of the way helicopters are built, certain type of helicopters have rotors which are more exposed and potentially closer to patrons. In one particular circumstance, following landing, the pilot walked immediately to the back of the helicopter without following each of the standard post-landing procedures. As a result of the spinning tail rotor, he lost his arm. Keep in mind, this was the pilot. Did he know that the helicopter has a tail rotor? Of course. Did he know the blades keep spinning after the engine stops? Sure. Did he do something stupid? You bet. Can you dream of a way he could try to blame his mistake on someone else? He sued the helicopter manufacturer. The basis for his suit was that the danger sign on the tail rotor wasn't big enough. If he didn't follow standard procedure, do you think he's going to read a sign of any size? Do you think this guy would still have an arm if the entire side of the helicopter had the letters DANGER in bold red type? Based on this guy's personal irresponsibility, nothing would have saved his arm unless the manufacturer built a helicopter with a seat beside the tail rotor, manned with a company official with a bullhorn whose job it is to scream and remind you that the tail rotor can blend you into pieces. There was no defect in the helicopter. Besides, common sense safety procedures are the responsibility of the pilot. Thank goodness the judge saw right through this and the pilot lost the case. This shouldn't have even gone to court, but this kind of thing happens when people don't acknowledge some truth about themselves. As you consider the principle, you can't change what you don't acknowledge, it's important to realize that change won't happen from simply acknowledging a problem. Neither acknowledgement or even belief is a magic bullet that makes positive change happen automatically. In fact, there are varying degrees of belief and even different kinds of beliefs about any given problem or solution. In the following example, remember that the how of believing will be answered in chapter 10 and chapter 14, so don't push to understand the how just yet. Consider someone who smokes. It's possible that they might not even think about the possibility that anything bad will come of their habit, and there is absolutely no reason to even consider quitting. Later, they might start to acknowledge that smoking is generally bad, and they might even acknowledge that someday it will affect them too. At this point, our smoker is in the acknowledgement stage. When a smoker starts adding up the financial and interpersonal costs of smoking, they start to see some negative health benefits for years of breathing tar smoke, our smoker might begin to believe that smoking is bad. He may even believe that he should quit smoking. So now he has a belief. Does that mean he will quit? Do you know people who still smoke in spite of their apparent belief that they should quit? A smoker will only quit when the belief changes from, I should quit, or I must quit, or I'll try to quit, to the much more effective belief, I will quit, in the words of Yoda, the Jedi Master. There is no try, either do or do not. Once a smoker believes he will quit, his actions will be consistent with that belief and he will quit. Now, of course, there are extenuating circumstances in this example. Someone might change beliefs midway and begin to smoke again. Their belief that they are too weak to stay away from cigarettes might be stronger than their belief that they have to quit. Another element is that new, empowering beliefs are only possible when the believer has control over the necessary circumstances. For example, a belief that you'll win the lottery will not necessarily make it happen. That's irrational optimism. In later chapters, specifically in the Section 3 chapters, we'll discuss the tools you can use to discover the things that are holding you back, help you identify some of the best steps you can take to eliminate limiting beliefs and behaviors, help you decide if a belief is an empowering and appropriate belief, and help you master these new beliefs, which will yield the best possible results in any circumstance. For now, simply take a couple of minutes and write down on a pad some of the negative results you're getting in your personal and financial life. Focus first on the poor results. What would you like to change? Is there something you've hoped or wished would get better but just didn't seem to improve in spite of your efforts? Here comes the hard part. Consider the possibility that you might have been ignoring some aspect of the negative situation because it would mean that you would have been wrong. Take a deep breath and try to put yourself in a humble frame of mind. Then on the same pad of paper below the negative results you've written down, write this phrase: because improving results is more important than my pride, I am willing to admit I may have been wrong about my approach to these problems. Something I haven't considered before is, and then make a list of new ideas. You're not looking for things you've tried that didn't work. You need to discover those things you might have considered but didn't try, or new things that you haven't acknowledged at all before. Finally, keep these items handy as you read the rest of the book so you can use them as a starting point for making improvements in your career and personal life. I hope that excites and inspires you to keep reading, but make sure you don't just jump straight to Section 3 right now. I want to share with you some more foundational information first. Most people need to unlearn some things they think they know before the tools in Section 3 can have maximum impact. Right now, I believe it's time for you to turn the page and read Section 2 so that you can unlearn a few pop psychology lies, and then Section 3 will really energize your life and your thinking. In Chapter 4, we covered: sometimes you can be too close to a problem to see it. It takes more than just a casual effort to recognize your own challenges. Once you recognize your problems in life and business, you have to commit to change them if you ever want things to improve. Even though denial may offer the appearance of a benefit in that you avoid problems in the short term, denial and procrastination simply don't provide consistent, positive outcomes in the long run. At this stage, you should try to uncover the things that you have denied in the past. Simple recognition doesn't automatically result in change. You'll learn how to change things later in the book. Excuses are pointless and just a waste of time. They don't help you overcome challenges, and they don't help you realize what you need to change. Regardless of how bad your life seems or how unfair things have been in your life, it's still your responsibility and no one else's to make change. This ends Chapter 4. Chapter 5. When life gives you lemons, don't drink the lemonade. A friend of mine used to say, when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. It almost didn't matter what the circumstance, she just always said it. Initially, there may appear to be truth in this statement. It sounds logical and optimistic. In the real world, though, when life or your business gives you lemons, don't drink the lemonade, at least not right away. When something big or bad happens in your life, it's rare that you can simply look at the bright side and move on. At least not right away. If you're not ready to move on for one reason or another, trying to force yourself to move on too soon can cause more damage, depression, and feelings of failure. Essentially, it's about timing. But to be more accurate, it's about personal timing. Personal timing is based on things like your experience and past challenges, intellectual knowledge, your personality, and your style. Whether someone else tells you or you tell yourself to move on or just get over it, you can only move on if you have the right attitude. Haven't you had someone give you the just get over it speech and it made you that much more upset? You probably thought, you don't understand. I just can't move on. Then just a day or two later, you have a conversation with someone and they tell you to get over it. You shake your head and say, you're right. I really have to get over it. It's time to move on. Another thing that determines the timing for you to drink the lemonade is the size of the lemon. The bigger the lemon, the worse the problem, and the more time you may need to get over the pain before you can make lemonade out of the lemons. The good news is that timing is proportional, not absolute. For one person, it might normally take a month to get over a divorce, or for someone else, it might normally take a year or more. In fact, some people never get over their problems. The better news is that you can use things like intellectual knowledge and the tools from this book to speed up your normal time frame. Maybe you need to go through 50 steps to be in a place where you're ready to overcome a lemon and move on. In later chapters, you'll discover tools that can help you do things like modify beliefs and behaviors, and you'll discover that there are ways to speed up your personal timing. Using the right tools can make your 50 steps happen in days rather than months. Don't fall into the trap of using personal timing as an excuse for inaction. I've just given you a factual principle with a great deal of power. The principle is that you may not be ready to move on right away. If you use that principle as an excuse to avoid any action, you're lying to yourself and you're in danger of never moving on. If you use the principle to understand intellectually that you may not be ready to move on, but there are things you can do to help you get ready to move on, then you've unleashed the power of the concept and it becomes an empowering principle instead of an excuse. You know where I've been in my life, so you know that my advice comes from the school of hard knocks. More than once, something painful has happened in my life which I was determined to get over. I've used this method several times in various forms, and it works well for me when big, painful things have happened. Because I don't want you to think that this works only on one particular type of problem, I'll leave the topic out of this explanation. I just want you to focus on my method and consider if something like this might help you get past a major life or business problem. I started by telling myself to move on. For some reason, the mantra, just move on, didn't work. Once I realized I couldn't move on because I wasn't ready, I thought about what would need to happen for me to be ready. I pictured a time in the future when I was over my problem, and I reasoned that I would need to experience the negative thoughts about my problem again and again until thinking about my lemon was just a non-emotional part of my past rather than an emotional, painful, debilitating thought. I decided to relive my lemon again and again. I concentrated on the bad stuff. I thought about it constantly. I experienced as much pain as I could fit into each day until I was numb. Finally, I had experienced the pain of my problem so much that I could begin to move on. Now, I don't recommend this approach for everyone, and it doesn't work for every situation, but what does work is what to do whenever you can take as many steps as possible to move past your lemon. If you're trying to help someone get past a divorce or business loss or some major life challenge, you must be empathetic first. Be sure your friend is ready before you push them to move on. So many times people don't know how to help a grieving friend, so they just tell their friend to get over it. Maybe they're just trying to help, but trying to force someone to move on too early is such a bad thing to do, they'd be better off saying nothing. It's better to have a heart without words than words without a heart. I recall spending time with a close friend who was recently widowed, and she shared with me that many of her friends kept telling her to move on. Move on? She'd been married for over 30 years and her husband had only died a few months earlier. I told her to keep crying her eyes out. When people told her she should move on, she felt even weaker as a person. She thought that she should be able to follow the advice of her friends. She felt more than just weak. She felt like something must be wrong with her because she couldn't move on. Though her friends meant well, their comments actually made her feel worse. Over 30 years of marriage and only 3 months to cry? Give me a break. It's not time for her to drink the lemonade. She had a huge lemon to deal with. When it comes down to being ready to move on, this is what you must realize. Time doesn't heal all wounds. You do. When you're helping a friend, make sure you give them time to absorb their circumstances before you push them to ignore their emotional attachment to the past and simply live happily ever after. Having said that, there will come a time for intervention. If you're close with a friend you're trying to help, you'll need to use your good judgment to distinguish between the time they need to experience necessary pain and the possibility that their depressed mood is becoming a habit that needs to be broken. Some people will need a close personal friend or a good professional counselor to help them take the first steps toward moving on. I have a friend who survived more than one rape. Just one assault like this is incredibly difficult for most anyone to deal with, but she had lived through three. Now, it might not seem logical if you don't know someone who has been attacked, but often victims blame themselves for being attacked. Imagine having been attacked on more than one occasion by different people. In a circumstance like that, it's almost inevitable that the victim would blame herself, and she did. A friend and I stopped by her house and made her go out with us. We took her to another friend's house for an informal gathering and got her mind off her troubles. This was a case of forcing someone to drink the lemonade. It wouldn't have worked if we waited for her to tell us that she was ready. My friend and I knew it was time and we intervened. You need to be really careful here because not everyone can make this kind of decision for friends. If you do it wrong, you can ruin your friendship or hurt the person you're trying to help, or both. Really big things can come from moving beyond life's problems. Now, you know my story, but let me tell you about a woman who's had a tremendous following and runs a multi-million-dollar enterprise. She has a true success story. Carol Gardner has been featured on Oprah and has a greeting card, book, and poster business that earns millions. It's based on her wit and wisdom coupled with great photos of her English bulldog Zelda in humorous costumes. Beginning with a winning entry in a greeting card contest, Gardner continued her greeting card success by creating an entire line of greeting cards. Zelda is now featured on cards, posters, figurines, snow globes, journals, notebooks, in 4 published books, and even on a line of Zelda apparel. What many Zelda fans don't know is that Zelda wasn't some corporate marketing department's brainchild. Zelda was a dog that was purchased because of Gardner's difficult divorce. She wanted to move on, but she wasn't sure how. Her lemons were the divorce, and her lemonade was a funny-looking English bulldog. Following the suggestion of a friend, she jokes that she had 2 options, get a therapist or get a dog. She got a dog, and the rest is history. In Chapter 5, we discovered when something overwhelming and negative happens in your business or life, it's rare that you can simply look at the bright side and move on immediately. You can use things like intellectual knowledge and the tools from this book to speed up your normal healing time. Often you can't move on until you're ready, but you can change how long it takes to be ready. This concludes Chapter 5. Chapter 6, Irrational Optimism. One of the things I wish for you as you read this book is that you'll come away from the experience with an enhanced ability to make very fine distinctions about emotions and perceptions. This book is filled with explanations and examples which I hope will help you understand nuances that might appear to be splitting hairs, but in the long run are quite different. For example, one of this book's chapters is called The Hoax of Positive Thinking, while another chapter is called Positive Thinking is a Lie, but it's a start. Until you actually delve into the content of these two chapters, their titles seem to suggest two totally opposite views on the topic of positive thinking. If you take any topic, cars, wine, cell phones, cooking, etc., there will be those who know the details of the topic far better than the general public. True aficionados can recognize practically imperceptible differences in the grade of a seasoning used in a recipe. True experts can often tell by taste where and when a wine originated. In each case, the differences might be subtle, but with expert training and practice, almost anyone can be taught to recognize these subtle distinctions. It's important that you try to study the explanations and examples I provided on these pages so you can actually begin to make distinctions yourself. And with practice, the distinctions become easier to identify. To draw the analogy even further, if you were looking for an expert to restore your vintage automobile, you'd likely prefer to hire someone who had worked on restoring similar cars before, and you'd probably feel like you hit the jackpot if you could find a mechanic who owned the exact same vehicle you intended to restore. If you plan to do your own work on your vehicle, taking lessons and advice from someone who had been there themselves is what most people would prefer. So when it comes to personal growth, business attitudes, tools for overcoming challenges, and understanding the fine distinctions necessary to move to the next level both personally and professionally, I will occasionally seem to be focusing on many distinctions that initially appear trivial. Each time you can grasp one of these subtle distinctions, you'll have mastered another tool on your way to mastering your own success. You need to be right in the frame of mind, alert and willing to learn, and then truly study the concepts in this chapter for them to make sense and not sound like double talk. In fact, simply understanding that the distinctions exist puts you in a class above the average citizen. For example, most people would consider the terms optimism and positive thinking to be synonyms representing a way of thinking. Some pop psychologists would go even further and say that positive thinking and optimism are a complete solution to bad life experiences and are a method to overcome challenges or even tragedies. That kind of oversimplification does more harm than good because it keeps people from understanding the truth about all the various types of optimism and the different types of positive thinking and how you can use them as an ingredient in combination with many other ingredients, which is part of a recipe for achieving success. Often this comes when you receive some type of positive influence or feedback, like the bowling strike, or a friend who thinks it helps to tell you that your idea is really great when it's not. Optimism itself isn't even the problem. The problem is that irrational optimism gives us false hope. If you're talking about the first time you went bowling, false hope is no big deal. There are times when false hope can be a useful tool, but we'll talk about that later. If you're talking about business plans, financial goals, personal goals, or relationship expectations, irrational optimism can be a really bad thing. A great example of irrational optimism is the TV show American Idol. People from all over the country audition, and then a few select finalists compete to sign a multi-million-dollar recording contract. Literally tens of thousands of people audition, but only one will walk away as the American Idol. There are even spin-offs all across the globe. The judges that conduct the regional auditions usually ask each contestant two questions. The first is, why do you want to be the next American Idol? And the second is, are you the next American Idol? If you hear an expert, quote-unquote, say optimism is the key to achieving your goals or fixing your problems or living your dreams, you need to immediately recognize that the expert is oversimplifying to the point of absurdity. That's like saying water is the key to losing weight. Are we talking about swimming? Does that mean we should eliminate food? Does that mean to drink more or less? Or maybe it means that we should hose down our lunch before eating. You see, it's crazy to oversimplify that much. I can't tell you how many experts offer that kind of shallow advice when it comes to personal and professional self-improvement. But now that you know what to watch for, you won't be fooled by their simple answers anymore. Irrational optimism is one of those subtle distinctions which appears to be hard to understand at first, but once you understand it, you'll be able to use it to your benefit. You can spot irrational optimism when people's actions are based on unbalanced or ridiculous ideas of success or positive outcomes. Let me share with you an example of how easy it can be to become irrationally optimistic. Think back to the first time you went bowling. You slipped on a pair of those funny-looking alley shoes and spent all kinds of time finding just the right ball to fit your hand. In spite of your preparation, you know practically nothing about the game itself, especially how to keep score. If you're like most people, you know that a strike is great, a spare is good, and a gutter ball is terrible. It's your turn, and you walk up to pick up your ball. You fit your fingers snugly into the holes, and you step up onto that wooden floor. You hold the ball under your chin with both hands, because that's what you've seen everyone else do, and you make your move. You take a few long strides, and as you approach the foul line, you let go of the ball, and bam, it slams hard onto the lane and rolls into the gutter, a gutter ball. It's probably what you expected. You wait your turn, and you try it again. As you keep bowling, you get a little better. You throw the ball again, and now you knock down four pins. Next time up, against all odds, you roll a strike. You're thrilled, and your friends are clapping and cheering for you. It's almost your turn again, and you start thinking about your strike. Here you are, never bowled a day in your life, and all of a sudden, you get a strike. A crazy thing happens at this point. Because you've made your first strike, you truly believe that you can do it again on your next turn. So you grab the ball with confidence, and you step onto the lane. Pacing yourself, you stride confidently forward and throw the ball. Your confidence was high, your approach and release felt good, and as it rolls down the alley, you see it veer off to one side and into the gutter. Another gutter ball. You may very well end up leaving your first day without ever getting another strike. The fact that you fooled yourself into believing that you could get a second strike immediately after your first lucky strike is truly irrationally optimistic. It's easy to be irrationally optimistic when you don't understand all of the factors that go into throwing strikes consistently. You don't have the experience. It is far more likely that your first strike was the result of a few accidental factors coming together than the skills you required during the first two frames. But because most people believe in their own abilities, frequently beyond logic and reason, it's easy to get caught up in being irrationally optimistic. Part of the fun audiences have watching the early phases of American Idol is the performances by people who are irrationally optimistic. It's hard to imagine some of these competitors believe they have a shot when their talent is obviously lacking. I have a saying in my office, everyone wants to be an American Idol. I use this saying when it comes to hiring people to join our sales team. We have a team of trainers that travel throughout the country and represent me at smaller events. We call these workshops of 100 or fewer people. To qualify for this position, candidates must be great public speakers. We'll view some of the videos from those who think they qualify. We send them a one-page sample script. To qualify for an interview, they must send us a video of themselves presenting the sample script. Some of the audition tapes are horrific. Everyone wants to be an American Idol. Most don't come anywhere near qualifying, yet they're somehow under the impression that their speaking talent is good enough to do it for a living. This kind of irrational optimism can cause us to make some very foolish decisions and set ourselves up for some serious failure. I have found that in general, most people, especially when setting a goal to attain something they may not have much experience doing, become very unrealistic when it comes to projecting their success. We seem to have a mental battle that goes on just beyond our conscious awareness. It takes place when we're planning what we'll be able to attain and when we think we can accomplish it. Here's what that internal conversation might sound like. I want to stay excited about my goal, so I'll tell myself that I'm going to hit this mark. I need to believe in this goal, however unreasonable it may be, because thinking about failing at my dream is far too painful. Because I don't want to think about that failure, I'll just ignore being reasonable. I'll ignore planning for possible failure. I'll just stay excited with the false hope of my dream. The unfortunate shame of our unrealistic belief in our dreams is that when we avoid even considering a plan B, we're destined for deep disappointment or even depression when our goal doesn't come to fruition. I've been just as guilty as anyone when it comes to being caught up in this kind of irrational optimism. I especially fell victim to all of this when I started getting more into personal growth and investigating some of this positive thinking stuff. I got the impression that all I would have to do is set a goal, pick a completion date, and voila, it was going to happen. Though that's an exaggeration of the process, I became so discouraged because I usually missed my target altogether, and if I did accomplish a goal, it was never on time. Over time, I realized I was a victim of irrational optimism. One important thing I came away with was the fact that I realized that attaining our goals usually take longer than we expect it to take. Once I realized this, I was able to make a more realistic approach to setting my goals. Previously, I was setting my goals based on emotions, not logic, which set me up for a big fall. In Chapter 10, Be Prepared to Abort or Lose an Engine, you'll see that there is a place for negative thoughts like thinking about what to do if you don't reach a goal. Having a plan B and being prepared for failure is one of the keys to avoiding irrational optimism. A secondary problem that comes from irrational optimism is that people frequently create negative associations to setting our goals. When you set a goal with lots of emotion and an irrational amount of optimism, and you don't achieve that goal, especially if that happens more than once, people can easily begin to think that setting goals is really a waste of time. We may reason, why set another goal? I'm just going to be disappointed when I don't reach it. Look at my last few goals. That was painful. I'll just avoid the pain by avoiding setting goals. Maybe you've heard the trite soundbite that a goal is a dream with a deadline. That's ridiculous. That kind of oversimplification leaves out so many aspects of reality that it's destined to cause more harm than good for practically everyone. The only place this philosophy ever worked was in Disney movies from the 50s. It may sound pessimistic at first, but there is a much healthier way to look at our goals. The mindset that I now have toward attaining my goals is that it's never as easy as it seems, and it's probably going to take longer than I think it will. I usually have to invest more blood, sweat, and tears than I originally planned. But my goal is worthwhile, and I'm committed to making it happen in spite of the unseen challenges. This is the beginning of a healthy attitude toward setting goals. Your goals can still be big and evoke powerful emotions, but logic and planning must be a part of the mix. Your goals might even seem wildly optimistic or even impossible to others, but if you have a solid plan to achieve your goals and alternate plans of actions for unexpected surprises along the way, your goals won't be irrationally optimistic. Exactly how to plan for the roadblocks, delays, and unexpected circumstances will become clearer in later chapters. For now, though, if you understand that a dream or a wish isn't automatically a goal, then you're headed in the right direction. You also need to make sure that you don't get hung up on the timeline or the investment of not hitting your initial projections. Plan for mistakes and allow for a cushion in both financial and workforce commitments. How many times do you hear people on the news telling you how much a project is expected to cost, and at the end of the project, it ends up taking longer than expected and costs millions, or in the case of many government projects, billions more? Eventually, you must come to the same realization as I did. If you don't attain your goals on time, it's not the end of the world. It's okay. Success should be a journey, not a destination. A great way to get a handle on this and save yourself from being overly discouraged when you don't reach a goal on time, or if your goal doesn't reach the level you'd like, is to realize that there is a cost to every goal. And you have to realize this before you start on your goal. If you ask almost anyone if they're willing to pay the price to reach their goal, they answer yes. Then if you ask them, what is the price that you'll have to pay to reach your goals? Most haven't taken the time to even figure that out. That's because it's easy to set a goal or have a dream if there's no investment associated with it. Once you tie a price to a dream and develop a plan of action, you've started to turn your dream into a goal, and you've also exponentially increased the likelihood of achieving that goal. It's true that facing the potential cost of our goal means facing reality, and it may just burst our bubble. I don't know about you, but I'd rather burst my bubble now than get so deep into a project that I can't get back out. This helps me see things very realistically, and it also helps remove some of the false hope. If people who are inexperienced in relationships would do a better job realizing this before they got married, they wouldn't be so let down when the honeymoon euphoria wears off. If he burps out loud on a date, he's gonna burp a lot louder after you marry him, and that's just half of it. I see this happen to so many people who start a business or get into sales. Due to their inexperience, they have many unrealistic goals. I've known people who really had what it takes, but because they approached their project with unrealistic expectations, they went bankrupt or quit. Many of these people then vow never to take on another risk because it could happen again. It's really sad. If they looked at things just a bit more realistically without becoming so irrationally optimistic, they would still be making their dreams come true. Again, it may seem pessimistic to plan for things to take longer than you expect or cost more than you plan, but while you're preparing for the unexpected occurrences along the path of your goal, you also have to plan for success. If you really have a great goal or business plan, you need to plan for big-time success. I've seen business become so successful that they start losing business because they hadn't planned for so much success. Some companies, divisions, sales teams, individuals, etc., aren't prepared for their success, and they miss opportunities or crash and burn because they couldn't meet demand. Part of your plan is to be ready for success that's even bigger than your goal. Keep in mind that the focus of the planning I've suggested so far has included just you and no outside opinions. I've mentioned that others might believe that your goals are unrealistic or irrational, and even if you value your friend's advice, it's more important for you to believe in your goals and to develop a complete plan for achieving them. And you need to fully develop your plan of action before you seek out opinions. Then when you finally do seek outside opinions, consider what strengths of judgment and experience with that topic the other person has, if any. I'd be willing to bet that most of the American Idol contestants' mothers believe that their child is brilliantly gifted and a sure thing. In fact, parents and friends are often where we learn some of our irrational optimism. Parents don't do their kids any favors by telling them how wonderful they are when they still need lots of practice at something. Of course, there are times to comfort children and bolster their confidence, but in the long run, it doesn't help a kid to continually hear false praise. Mentors are a good place to go when fleshing out the details of your plans because presumably they've been there before. There are pros and cons about using mentors. On the plus side, they have experience and thinking ways that your other friends might not. Chapter 7, The Hoax of Positive Thinking. Positive thinking is overrated. One of the most common things you'll hear from people is to just think positive. Somehow, by just remembering happier times in your life, you're supposed to be able to use those good feelings to overcome your current negative life experiences. It sounds logical, and it gives people something to do that are busy working on a project to start feeling better. The problem is that positive thinking is a lie, and it doesn't work. There are four key reasons positive thinking doesn't work. First, positive thinking, even if it seems to work, doesn't last long. Second, positive thinking is absolutely ineffective if you're not at the right point in your life. Third, when it doesn't work, people think it's because they're not doing it right, and they get more discouraged. Fourth, positive thinking is often presented as the solution rather than a simple, limited, useful tool. There are other reasons that positive thinking doesn't work, and these will become apparent as this chapter unfolds. Positive thinking is like spray paint on rust. It doesn't last long. This statement illustrates perfectly the first problem with positive thinking. If you master the positive thinking exercises that quote-unquote experts tell you will help improve your situation, you may appear outwardly to have overcome your problem or problems. Inwardly, however, you are not convinced that your problems have been resolved, and the continued underlying issues must be resolved for you to overcome your problems. Ironically, some personalities can even develop further, deeper problems if they just mask their symptoms by thinking positively. Many times you've heard TV interviews with family members or former schoolmates of some criminal or suicide victim where they say, "But he seemed like everything was fine." My spray paint analogy comes from the fact that I enjoy all aspects of aviation, including the mechanics and bodywork on planes and helicopters. Now, if you spray paint a rusted spot, you can make it look better for a while, but the repair won't last long, and because the underlying problem is still there, and you're only masking the situation. The problems will always grow even worse under the surface. For a spray-painted repair to last, you need to prepare the surface first. Sanding the surface, removing the corrosion and grease, and priming the surface are all necessary steps to make paint last. In the same way, you need to handle all of your problems directly first. This book is loaded with insights to help you understand what the problems are with Pop Psychology Solutions in Section 2 and real-world tools to help you overcome your problems and get the results you want in Section 3. The second problem with positive thinking is that it's absolutely ineffective if you're not in the right place in your life. For positive thinking to have the remotest possibility of beginning to help, you have to have the right mindset first. You wouldn't expect someone in the throes of grief because they've just lost their spouse in a traffic accident to be able to snap out of it or look at the bright side right away. When I lost my father and uncle, I heard a lot of this kind of drivel. In fact, I came to hate the following phrases: "Look at the bright side. It's not that bad. It will get better." And the prize winner at the very bottom of my list: "It could be worse." I guess people wanted to help me and make me feel better, and in retrospect, it's nice to know that people cared, but telling me to feel better was the last thing that I needed. Positive thinking was worthless for me because I wasn't ready. Keep in mind that people don't mean any harm, and they're not being stupid when they say these things. Most times, they truly have your best interest at heart, and they mean well. It's just they aren't trained communicators, or they don't understand that these platitudes don't really help. Let me illustrate a step further what I mean by being ready. Imagine that I invite you over to my house, and we're going to bake some cookies. I get everything all mixed up, and we put the cookies in the oven. They smell so good. I hand you a cookie, and as you take a bite, you look at me and say, "Gary, something just doesn't taste right." We look over to the counter and discover that you're absolutely right. I forgot to put the eggs in the mix. You don't have to be a rocket scientist or a professional chef here, but wouldn't you agree that for most cookies, not all, but for most cookies to taste right, you usually have to have eggs in the ingredients? Sure. So I go over to the counter and take the eggs, and I proceed to crack them and put them in the bowl. I get the raw eggs all mixed up. Now I take your cookie back from you and dip it in the raw eggs. I wish I could see your face now. But didn't we agree not even 10 seconds ago that we had to have eggs in the ingredients? And wouldn't you also agree that there is a difference between having eggs on the cookie or in the cookie? So you think about it. If we wanted these cookies to taste right, technically, we're going to have to start, you guessed it, from scratch. We had all of the right ingredients, but the problem wasn't the eggs. It's that they needed to go into the recipe in the right order. Positive thinking will never work if it's not the right time for it. The third point is that when positive thinking doesn't work, lots of people think they're doing something wrong, and they get even more discouraged. I don't know about you, but for me, reading some of the positive thinking books and listening to the experts, I get the impression that they believe all we have to do is just say to ourselves, life is great, it's going to be a great day no matter what, and everything's going to work out just fine. I think you'll agree that life is a bit more complicated than that. As I said earlier, I've been in the depth of clinical depression, and I think I earned it. I was craving answers to the how do you keep going question, and think positive seemed to be the only answer people could offer. I assure you it was no help. I kept trying to think positive, but my mind was so full of negative thoughts, and I was in such a low place, it didn't do a thing for me. The real problem was more than me simply not being ready for the positive thinking process. My big problem was that so many people said positive thinking was the answer that I was sure it must be. I must be doing something wrong, as if I didn't have enough problems. Now, I wasn't doing positive thinking correctly. I didn't need that kind of pressure. So we've discovered that positive thinking can work, but only when two things are in place first. And you must master these two things in order for positive thinking to work for you. Without these two ingredients, you're cracking raw eggs. You must have the right timing and the right attitude. Let's discuss timing. It truly is all about timing. You can't tell a person whose wife just told him that his baby really isn't his, look on the bright side of things, at least you don't have to pay child support for the next 18 years. How insensitive. Or imagine someone telling you after you've lost three family members, at least you have some family left. People mean well when they try to help others by saying positive things. But if the timing isn't right, it's not going to work. We may even be viewed as rude or insensitive. I've seen it happen dozens of times. Maybe you've even caught yourself saying things like this to others. But if the tables were turned, you might very well be pushed further down by the helpful advice. A group of friends were hanging around, and one person in the group started to cry. No one knew what was wrong. I started to walk toward her to see if there was anything that I could do to help. Before I got to her, a lady, whom we'll call Beth, walked up to her and put her arm around her and asked what was wrong. I could overhear the lady who was crying saying in response, someone in her family had recently died. Beth, meaning well, said, "You can get over it. My son died, and I was able to move on." A perfect illustration of bad timing. That statement might have helped at a later time if the grieving woman had asked if it's possible to get over such a pain because she was just beginning to deal with her loss. Timing is everything. What should she have said? Probably nothing. A good, long, sincere hug would have been a lot more effective. We need care and consoling, not trite sayings. In time, she will be able to move on. In the previous sentence, there's a very interesting clue about the healing process. It is the word time. Every day you hear people say, time heals all wounds. I agree that there is some truth in this statement, but it's far from a complete thought. I don't know about you, but if I had to wait on time to heal all my many wounds that I've experienced, I'd still be bleeding to this day. I've actually found the following statement to be far more helpful and enlightening when I'm trying to help someone. Timing doesn't heal all wounds. You do. We have the choice to let time heal our wounds, but that doesn't give you any control, and it doesn't always work. Another problem is that, for time to heal your wounds, you have to wait. If you had a painful experience in the past that was blocking you from present-day happiness or stopping you from maybe increasing your income, wouldn't you rather get over that hurdle as soon as you can? Or would you be willing to wait for time to heal the wounds whenever time gets around to it? Most people would agree that it's far more satisfying, empowering, and fulfilling to be in control and deciding our direction in life as opposed to letting things happen to us. The method to healing your own wounds and not waiting on time may not be an easy one to apply. This is because for everything you want out of life, you must give something up. Your ability to heal your own wounds depends on how much of this something you are willing to give up. The something in this case is comfort. It's making the decision to take the more difficult path in order to move beyond your present circumstances. Instead of letting life simply carry you along, you can make the decision to overcome the pain of a loss and force the healing that would normally happen over time to happen more quickly. This frequently means moving beyond your comfort zone. It means refusing to wait for time to pass in order for healing to happen. If you think of this in direct comparison to a flesh wound, there are many parallels. In time, most any non-fatal flesh wound will heal. The really bad ones take more time than the small scrapes. Sometimes to treat a critical wound, you must endure a bit more short-term pain and crying while the doctor cleans the wound and sutures it. Ultimately, though, a treated wound will heal faster and more completely with less scarring than if you simply tried to ignore the injury. Even for people who understand this analogy, they may not know what the prescribed treatment should be, so they just let time do its thing. In practically every case, you must let time help you get past the initial shock of your tragedy or loss. However, once you pass the initial shock, you can begin to take control and speed your healing process. Unaided people take years to move on. They let their past rent space in their head for years. Some even take it to their graves with them. For each individual, it's a personal choice as to how much time you'll allow to pass before you start taking the aggressive approach you're about to learn. Your personality, mindset, and attitude will determine the speed of your process. If you haven't adopted the proactive type of mindset, you may want to read the entire book before you try to begin forcing the following technique on yourself. That's because the last section, and especially the last two chapters of this book, will give you stories about what it's like to master your own circumstances and truly take control. I wish I had known how to take control and move on like I do now. I thought, like most people do, that the best answer is just to power through the hard times. I recall some of my mental bouts after going through all the things I did. The depression was like nothing I had ever experienced. I had days of constant crying, and I couldn't even imagine how I could move on. I couldn't keep a steady relationship for the life of me. I was consumed with self-doubt, and if I felt a girlfriend was going to break up with me, I would lose it. In looking back, even I'm amazed that I finally made it. One of my major challenges was learning to handle any type of rejection. Not just in relationships, it affected my business life too. As I started various businesses, I exposed myself to a tremendous amount of rejection. I know now that this is a necessary part of any entrepreneurial venture, but I wanted all the gain without the risk. I worked to earn as much as I could, and then I invested large sums of money in a new business venture, only to have the whole thing fall apart. The moment I felt something had failed, I would immediately remember all the other pain of my past at the same time. Every one of the failures and troubles in my past seemed to conspire to hit me all at once, business-related or not. That's a lot of pain for one person to handle. That made it even harder to keep going. I kept thinking, if I'm destined to keep failing, and each failure just brings up all my other failures, I had better quit soon because I don't know if I can take any more pain. Ultimately, you have to deal with past pains because there will come a time when you will no longer just power through. I liken it to snow on a roof of a building. Buildings are built with strong roofs. They're designed to handle snow. Nevertheless, as the snow builds up, if it's not removed, it starts getting heavier and heavier. Eventually, the roof will cave in. Our emotions can be that way as well. The more painful the past, the more snow you have on the roof. I'm not interested in discovering how strong my roof is, so as I get snow on my roof, I start shoveling before it gets too heavy. Dealing proactively with negative things from your past is like shoveling and reinforcing your roof all at the same time. So how much time should you let pass in order to get beyond the initial pain of a problem before you take control and change circumstances in order to move on? We've all heard our parents preach the following adage: when you fall off the horse, get right back on it. We've all heard this before, and we've all told others to do it. When we say get right back on the horse, we mean right away, don't wait. But what makes it so difficult to get back on the horse now? It's because you're still feeling the emotional and or physical pain. Getting back on the horse right now seems to be too much too soon. But what's the payoff if we do manage to get right back on the horse anyway? We master the situation and we don't let it rent space in our head. Waiting to get back on a horse a week or months from now doesn't usually help. If anything, the longer we wait, the more intensive affair we will begin to develop. This will only serve to make it that much harder to try to get back on the horse in the future. The old adage speaks of horses, though. I'm not saying if your spouse dies, start dating the next day. Or if you've invested a lot of money in something and it fails, dump more into it immediately. There needs to be a time to feel the pain, but how long you need to feel this pain before you move on is up to you. And I want you to notice that I won't tell you what specific time frame is right. It depends on your personality and the circumstances, and everyone is different. I'm always intrigued when people respond judgmentally when someone remarries quickly after the death of a spouse or following a divorce. How long should a person wait? 9 months? A year and a half? What's the right answer? How about 14 months, 2 weeks, and 3 days? Silly, isn't it? Why should it be our business? It shouldn't matter if the people involved are able to move on. If they can truly move on quickly, then great for them. It's important to understand that people who think that the hurt person may be moving on too fast quickly might be imposing their own time frame on the situation. Maybe for them, if they moved on that quickly, they would still be on the rebound and it would be a bad move. If the involved person has moved past the point where a relationship would be a rebound relationship, regardless of how little time has passed, then moving on is exactly what that person should do. For me personally, I usually want to try to move on as quickly as I can, but let me break that down a little. I'm not talking about starting a new relationship right away. I just wanted to get over my divorce so I could be ready for the possibility of a new relationship as quickly as possible. As for business, I want to march forcefully forward as quickly as I can while making sure I'm headed in a profitable, promising direction. Power tip. Passion is great, but without fuel, passion dies quickly. When you're in a very depressed, discouraged, or negative state, it's hard to adopt this attitude unless you have committed to this course mentally before it all hits the fan. Planning ahead like this must be a way of life. Otherwise, it would be like trying to learn to swim when you're drowning. Not the best time to take lessons or to try to be self-taught. Some people reading this book may be drowning now. Instead of trying to move on quickly right now, take the time to read the whole book and use some of the little techniques as a life preserver. Make it to shore and rest a little so you can learn from the past and deal with the future with a more prepared mindset. I mentioned that I wanted to move past the pain of my ex-wife, and because personal tragedies are frequently more difficult to overcome than business failures, at least on a deep emotional level, I had to do some pretty challenging things to get over my divorce. As you read the following story, you'll realize that if you want to try something like this, it will be a lot easier said than done. But in the end, I assure you, it was worth it for me. Because of Andrew's frame of mind, I knew anything that I would say to him would be like positive thinking. In this setting, positive thinking is like spray paint on rust. When someone says to you, "I wish I were dead," he had obviously lost all hope and purpose. The typical helpful rapid-fire comments like, "But you've got your friends. Look at all these cards and flowers you have. God loves you. Your family loves you." Comments like these are just positive thinking and will even push someone in a hopeless state further away. It also communicates that you just don't get it or understand. As I left the hospital room, I must admit I felt a bit helpless myself. All I could say was, "Andrew, hang in there." Anything more would just be spray paint on rust. The next day, I received another phone call. This time, the person on the other end told me that Andrew was sent home because that's where he had chosen to die. I don't know what it was about that call, but a light went on inside my head, and I thought I had come up with a way to give Andrew some hope and purpose. Four of us went to Andrew's house and virtually ransacked his place. We cleaned the toilets, we cleaned the kitchen, and at some point I walked past his room. As fragile as he was, Andrew straightened up in his bed. He had tears in his eyes, and he said, "I never realized that people cared." Now I'm thinking, what are you talking about? You have all these flowers and get well cards. What do you mean you didn't realize that people cared? You see, sending flowers and cards is the proper thing to do, but often it can be meaningless to some when it's expected. For whatever reason, we chose to do something unexpected. The fact that this was a different display of caring seemed to reach Andrew on a level that he hadn't experienced from the cards and flowers. It was a thing he needed to realize that people really did care. In the same frame of mind he shared at the hospital, we could have told him 10,000 times, "Don't you realize that people care? Don't you realize that we care?" Words like that were what he expected, and we both knew it wouldn't have changed anything. My friends and I decided to show Andrew that we cared in a different way, and the good news is that we carried on for years after this. We occasionally stopped by and fixed things in his house, and he loved the attention and visits. His hope was alive and well. It's kind of funny, but we reasoned, if you clean the inside of Andrew's house and he lives happily for several more years, imagine what would happen if we cleaned the outside of his house. After a couple of years, about 10 or 15 of us did the outside, and Andrew lived for several more years. Was it the clean house that helped Andrew's recovery? No, he recovered because his hope and his purpose were back. This kind of drive from life's purpose can keep you up at night and get you up in the morning. Look for the things that you add to those sharing the planet with you. How do you improve the lives you touch? Are there special gifts you share? I encourage you to find these kinds of special things about you in life and business, and when you think you found enough, find some more. You can never have enough hope or purpose. It makes your life full and rich. Another advantage of doing all this is that it is inevitable that something bad or negative will happen to you. The more purpose and hope you have in life, the quicker you'll usually bounce back. Let's talk about hope in business. One of my good friends told me that this is his favorite lesson from my seminar. The concept is that in business, the more projects you have going, the more hope you have. If one of your projects goes bust or falls through, you still have all the other avenues to pursue, and one of them is sure to pay off. My friend is an entrepreneur, and he had been in business for years. He was usually doing fine with occasional ups and downs, but he never seemed to break through to the next level. He was almost always in a good mood and had a positive outlook, but he always seemed to be at the mercy of a poorly paying client or waiting to see if some big project was going to pay off. Every time one of his big projects fizzled out, it would take him weeks or even months to get back on track financially. He dropped by one of my seminars, as he did from time to time, and he was familiar with most all of the lessons I taught. For some reason, that day he focused on the business idea that more projects means more hope, and he started to brainstorm all the little projects he could adapt his business to pursue. Inside 3 weeks, he had begun work on more little projects than he ever had started at once. None of the projects had yet planned out, but his normal positive attitude was through the roof. I asked him if he was in a good mood because his latest big business plan had worked, and he said that wasn't it. He was in such a great mood and busier than ever because he had so many things going on that one or more of them were sure to pay off. He was prospecting the new clients in ways he had never pursued before. At the same time, he was developing new products and services to deliver to a wider audience. He was trying all kinds of things, and in the long run, the ones that paid off big had been on his back burner for years. He was always waiting until one of his big projects paid off so he'd have the free time to pursue this other little project. His business cycle changed from big ups and downs to constant, steady growth on a big scale. The more projects, more hope idea had helped him balance his workload, and when one of his projects didn't go as planned, he still had all kinds of hope because of the many other things that he had going. His hope and his attitude were fine-tuned to keep him moving forward. Power tip: the farmer can't harvest his field by simply thinking about it. Attitude is so important, and we must use concepts like these to develop a strong one before we need it. When tough times happen, they can wreak havoc on your attitude. If you don't have a good attitude to begin with, you're going to need to learn to swim real fast. When I think about timing, attitude, and positive thinking, a funny story comes to mind. Years ago, I walked into the post office to mail something, and as I opened the door, a man was yelling at the postmaster. At this point, another author would probably make some joke about yelling at postal employees and why that's a bad idea, but I'll take the high road and pass on that opportunity. Now, based on the hot-headed frame of mind the postal patron was in, you couldn't just walk up to him and say, "Hey guy, it's not that bad, just calm down," at least not unless you were wearing a helmet and a bulletproof vest. So as he was yelling, I listened for a moment to understand where he was coming from, and I walked toward him. I raised my voice just a bit lower than him, and I said a few things that made him think that I had taken his side. I started complaining to the postmaster along with him. Now he thought someone agreed with him and was taking his side. He loved it. The postmaster and all the people in the lobby probably thought, "Now we've got two wackos in here. I hope I said I love you to my family today before I left." So as we were both carrying on, I gently grabbed his arm and said, "It's not worth it, let's go." End of confrontation. By the way, I don't recommend joining an argument like this. As a regular customer, I knew the postmaster and the postal employees knew I wasn't a threat. Positive thinking by itself has long been an answer suggested by pop psychologists and pushed by well-meaning friends to help people get through tough times, but it's just a small piece of the big puzzle. Things like attitude, timing, and hope all figure into a person's ability to get to the positive thinking phase. In this chapter and the pages that follow, I have provided a host of tools you can use to get through tough times or to move from wherever you are to the next level. I hope that positive thinking will always be a part of your life because you understand its place in the bigger picture, not because it seems to be an answer in and of itself. Take some time to consider all the ways you touch others' lives and anything that gives you hope on a personal level. Consider what you're doing in business and think about additional things you might do to improve your company's position if current projects don't go as planned, or to branch out to attract more clients and additional streams of income. And while you're thinking about these things, keep in mind that you are laying the foundation so that you can have an attitude that will help you be resilient when the tough times come. You'll be able to respond more quickly, regain control, and keep moving forward. And even though positive thinking may happen as part of your plan, you won't have to wait for time to heal your wounds or positive thinking to fix things. You're more powerful than that now. In Chapter 7, we covered positive thinking alone solves nothing. Positive thinking doesn't fix the underlying problem, so it's like spray paint on rust and it won't last long. Positive affirmations are equally ineffective. Positive thinking is only occasionally effective as an ingredient in a bigger recipe of pulling your life together. Timing is an ingredient that influences the effectiveness of positive thinking. Time doesn't heal all wounds. You do. Your personality, mindset, and attitude will determine the speed of your process. You can choose to do whatever it takes to get over business and personal challenges as quickly as possible, but when you're in a very depressed, discouraged, or negative state, it's hard to adopt this attitude unless you have committed to this course mentally before it all hits the fan. Hope is a key element to the ability to move on. Frequently, hope comes naturally, but if it seems to be missing, you can generate it for yourself, especially in business if you plan ahead, and others can help you feel more hope too. In business, the more projects you have going, the more hope you have. If one of your projects goes bust or falls through, you still have all your other avenues to pursue, and one of them is sure to pay off. positive thinking has its place, and in that way, it's a good thing, but it's never an answer by itself. This concludes Chapter 7. This is the end of CD 2.